On September 22, 1928, a four-year-old girl disappeared in the woods near Messina, New York. At some point in the panic search that followed, someone speculated that the child may have been murdered by a Jewish resident of the community in a ritual sacrifice. This was blood libel, a well-documented anti-Semitic slander common in Europe, but new to the United States. Today's guest details the case and places it in historic and contemporary context. He's Edward Berenson this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, artists, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Edward Berenson, a professor of history at New York University. He's the author of several books, including the recently published and critically acclaimed The Accusation, Blood Libel in an American Town. Ed, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
So let's just define this for those folks who might not know what blood libel is. Tell us what it is.
Blood libel, it's just a really horrifying accusation against Jews. And the accusation goes that Jews, for their religious rituals, need to use the blood of a Christian child. And so when you think about that, that's got to be one of the ugliest myths of anti-Semitism that's out there.
And it does not have deep roots in the United States, but it has extensive history of propagation around the rest of the world.
That's right. It goes all the way back to the 1100s in England, which is the first incidence of that. And then throughout the Middle Ages, these accusations pop up regularly, routinely, until around 1600 or so. Then during the Protestant Reformation, you see less of it because there's a witch craze that goes on that sort of takes over. And then there's a revival in Europe in the late 19th century of these accusations against Jews. And between 1880 and the First World War, there were about 100 documented blood libels against Jews in various European countries.
It's an anti-Semitic slander.
It's an anti-Semitic slander. I mean, and then when you look at the details, I mean, I'm sorry to be graphic about this, but there are works of art from the Middle Ages. Some of them are up on the walls of churches in places like Italy, where you see a figure of a Jew who's stuffing a baby into a barrel, and the barrel has spikes sticking out. And then there's another figure of a Jew who's collecting the blood as it drips out from this baby. There's graphic images of this sort of thing all throughout European history. Mm.
So why would people hundreds of years ago, and we'll get to the present soon, but why would people hundreds of years ago believe such a thing? I mean, it transcends, you know, just pure bigotry, it seems to me.
So there's just a huge amount of hostility against Jews in the period when just about everybody in Europe becomes a Christian. And so the Jews are the people who persist in not seeing the light, who persist in being backward, and therefore seen as being dangerous, and are also seen as having murdered Christ because they're so unwilling to see the light. And so originally this accusation against Jews is a kind of reenactment of the crucifixion. And in the first accusations, and it's really important to use this word because there has never been any evidence that anything like this actually happens.
Ever.
Right.
Ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Exactly.
So forget it.
Yeah.
And so, but the first one, the first accusations against Jews involved the allegation that the Jews crucified a young child before they killed him. What historians who've really looked into this in detail think is that the blood got mixed into this. So at first, there was no thought that the point was to collect blood for religious rituals. The idea was you're reenacting the crucifixion. But in 1215, transubstantiation, that is the idea that bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ.
The literal body and blood of Christ.
So this becomes a dogma of the church, which means
it was not a dogma until that point.
Exactly.
So
it becomes a dogma in 1215, and the dogma means, of course, that if you're a Catholic, you must believe this. Mm-hmm. You must believe this. And so there were a lot of good Christians who didn't believe this. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And so the church really put in a lot of effort to stamp out what they now consider to be a heresy. Well, of course, the Jews were never going to believe in anything like this. And so they became the ultimate heretics. And because they wouldn't believe in this transformation of wine into blood, the idea sort of got out there that the Jews must use real blood in their own rituals.
So the first case, and you write about this in your book, dates to the 12th century in England, in a writer monk, Thomas of
Monmouth.
Yeah. Monmouth.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that. That's the origin of blood libel, as best you could find it in your research.
Right, right. And so it was alleged to have happened in 1147, and there was a young boy who turned up dead, and with no evidence at all, this monk named Thomas of Monmouth claimed that the Jews crucified and murdered this child. And he further claimed that the Jews would do this once a year around Easter time, which is also, of course, Passover, and that this ritual would take place in a different spot. And in 1147, it took place, so the allegation went, in Norwich, England. And most people didn't believe this. I mean, there was nothing that happened that connected the death of this child. And unfortunately, in the 1100s, children died young all the time from all kinds of things, from diseases. I mean, we didn't have anything like modern medicine. But then what happened around 1150 is that people began to observe miracles taking place in this area. And then Thomas of Monmouth was able to make the connection. Well, so the martyred child became a miracle worker and therefore a saint. And so this proves the allegation that miracles were taking place. And then this allegation then jumped over onto the European continent, where it began to be copied. And after 1215, it morphed into the blood libel.
Well, so it's one of my questions. Yeah. So, you know, in 2019, we have social media, and we've got 8chan, and we've got all these little dens of conspiracy theory and rumor mongering that exist online.
Right.
In the 13th and the 12th and 13th centuries, How does this rumor spread?
So that's a great idea. I mean, a great question. And there are certain people who travel around, right? There are people involved in commerce and religious figures. Monks travel around to different monasteries, and there also is a medium in common, which is the Latin language. And so, all educated people, wherever they live, they can read and write the same language. And so, of course, there's no printing press yet, there's no modern medium, but there is a common language, unlike nowadays, that links all literate people together. And so you have monks traveling around, you have people involved in various forms of commerce traveling around, and they bring those rumors with them.
This was an era of great superstition anyway, so it seems like that would be fertile ground for even such a ridiculous notion as blood libel. Is that true?
Well, yeah. So this it's a pre-scientific age, and right. So there are all kinds of things that happen that nobody can explain. And so human beings, one of the things that we do is we search for explanations. We understand why something happened. And so in the absence of anything resembling science, you come up with answers. And so nowadays we call that superstition. But back then it was a way of understanding the mysteries of the world, why certain things happened.
Am I right in thinking that this particular slander, the blood libel slander, is central to a lot of the history of anti-Semitism, particularly the pogroms that swept through various parts of Europe in the following centuries?
Almost always after one of these accusations against Jews, there is violence against Jews. Violence that involves killing and destruction of property. And some of those those forms of violence become so extensive that we could call them pogroms. The pogrom is a mass killing of Jews. And one of the things that's particularly depressing about all this is that when Jews who are accused of these murders get put on trial, starting in the Renaissance, they were getting toward a more modern age, and so the idea is that you can't just level an accusation, you have to put someone on trial. How fair those trials were, of course, was another story. And there were occasions when Jews were acquitted. It didn't matter. There was violence anyway. There was violence anyway. And this particularly happened in the modern period, in the 19th century, when this blood libel becomes a thing again, a common thing.
And it was a thing again, particularly in Germany, and parts of Russia. Is that correct?
Throughout Eastern Europe, what's now Germany, Poland, Hungary, what's now the Czech Republic, parts of Italy, starting in the late 1880s. But it's especially in what's now Poland, Ukraine, various Eastern European countries. I mean, this is the center of Jewish life in a lot of ways during this period, because this is also one thing that a lot of Americans don't know, is that starting in the 1200s, Jews were ejected from essentially every major Western European country, England, France, Germany.
When you say ejected, you mean what we would call deporting?
Yeah, kicked out. And so Jews moved east, where the situation was more accommodating to them. And then when the Ottoman Empire took over in 1453, the Ottoman Empire was actually much more open to Jews than places like England and France.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who's the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Edward Berenson, a professor of history at New York University. He's also the author of The Accusation, Blood Libel in an American Town, a searing examination of the one case of blood libel in the United States.
You talk about the violence of the pogroms. It was really brutal violence. I mean, it was the slaughtering of men, women, children. It was the pillaging and burning of homes and businesses. I mean, it was wide-scale, horrible violence.
Right, and you start to see that sort of violence in the beginning in the 1880s in Russia. And one of the worst pogroms comes on the heels of the assassination of the Tsar. And Jews are blamed for this unfairly. And there then is a mass killing of Jews, destruction of property, and life becomes really difficult for Jews.
So this would be a foreshadowing of the Holocaust, would it not, in some, at least symbolically, some sense?
It's a complicated thing because the Holocaust is unique in the sense that it was totally planned by a government that enacted a very elaborate set of policies to exterminate entire people. And so the pogroms, as horrible as they are, and I don't want to play down the horror by any means of the pogroms, these were not planned centrally. That historians used to think that the Russian government sort of pulled the trigger on this, or at the very least acquiesced to it, and there doesn't seem to be much evidence for that. It's more local nobles and local elites who sort of fanned the flames of these pogroms, and so that makes it different. I mean, when you have the state, when you have the government that is organizing and managing and pushing something.
A modern industrial state with all of the trappings of modern statehood
exactly.
And power.
You mobilize the power of the modern state, the modern bureaucracy, with modern technology, and you can do a lot more damage.
So we've heretofore we've been focused on sort of the European experience with blood libel, but your book, The Accusation, is about an example, so far the only example, of blood libel in the United States. Just sketch out the rough outlines of the story for us.
Right. So I just want to say that I was born in Messina, New York, which is the scene of my book and the scene of the only known case.
Did you grow up there? You were just born there?
My father grew up there, and my parents were there until I was about three. But his whole family, father's whole family, stayed there, and so we would visit every summer. And
so you were very familiar with
it? I was very familiar.
As a young person.
I heard this story growing up. And
you did?
Oh, yeah, always.
Really?
This story was in the lore of the family, you know, because it's such a kind of horrifying thing, and because it was unique in American history. And so that was the sort of question that got me going, you know. Well, this is a European thing, it's unknown in the United States. Why did you have this one case that all of a sudden surfaced in September of 1928? It was a puzzle that I was just really desperate to try to figure out.
So it's September 22nd, 1928, what happens?
So, a little girl, four-year-old girl named Barbara Griffiths. Excuse me. She's playing off on her own, and her brother. The kids are supposed to come home at 6 for dinner, and so this is a time when everybody felt so safe that you could let a 4- and a 6-year-old kid out to play on their own, right? I mean, no one would do that nowadays. And so Barbara's brother Bobby came home as usual at 6 o'clock, and Barbara didn't come home. And so their dad, Dave Griffiths, said, well, Bobby, organize your friends. Let's go find Barbara. And so the kids went out. They couldn't find her. And then Barbara's parents got alarmed. And so they got together, a group of people, and started combing the woods surrounding where they lived for the little girl. And they couldn't find her. And by 9, 10 o'clock at night, there were 300 people from a village of only about 10,000 who were searching everywhere for the little girl, and they couldn't find her. And at some point during the night, and we don't know exactly when, but at some point during the night, the rumor started to circulate that the Jews had captured Barbara, killed her to drain her blood for their religious rituals. And so This story, this accusation, was all too depressingly common in Europe, but it had never happened in the United States. It never happened where an entire community. I mean, there were cases of an immigrant from Poland, say, where this kind of thing had happened, and would accuse a neighbor who she was angry at or he was angry at of, you Jews kill babies, but never had there been an allegation in the aftermath of a child seeming to disappear that mobilized an entire community.
Were you able to figure out where the accusation comes from?
No. So the short answer is no. I mean, I can't find any evidence that would have allowed me to pinpoint this. But what we do know from all kinds of reports that left traces in archives and various spots, that at some point during the night, this idea took hold. It took hold to the point where some of the searchers who couldn't find the little girl in the woods, they went back into the town and they shined their flashlights into the windows of the Jewish shops, thinking they might find the body there.
How big was the Jewish community in Messina?
100 people.
100 people.
100 people.
And a population of 10,000, you said?
10, 12,000, yeah.
And were these relatively recent newcomers to the community?
Yes. So the Jews all came between the 1890s and the period right around the First World War, because, as you know, in 1924, there was an immigration act that basically cut off just about all immigration from the places where Jews and Italians and others came in such large numbers in the late 19th and early 20th century. And so we think, we're not positive, but there's pretty good evidence that my great-grandfather was, and my great-grandmother were, the first Jewish residents of Messina, New York, and they landed there in 1898. I've got a wonderful picture in my book of my great-grandparents with my grandmother, Harriet, on their lap. My grandmother lived to age 100, right?
Wow.
And so to sort of see a picture of my grandmother as a baby was really, really quite something. And so that my great-grandparents started a move in which a number of Jews ended up in this town. Why do they end up there? Because suddenly it became an industrial town, because an Alcoa plant opened up in 1902, and the Alcoa plant opened up because of the St. Lawrence River, which provided the hydroelectric power for this plant. And so that's when Jews, seeing business opportunities, settled in the town.
So you said you were not able to trace the origin of blood libel in this incident. Can you even speculate? Historians don't tend to speculate, but
well,
for the sake of this discussion,
several of my chapters speculate. I think there's really good circumstantial evidence that explains how and why this happened in September of 1928. And so there are really four major pieces to this puzzle. The first piece is immigration.
Yeah.
And a huge percentage of the workforce at Alcoa were immigrants. The Messina, New York, which is, it sits right at the very northern tip of New York State. It takes 8 hours to drive there from New York City.
And right on the Canadian, it's right on the St. Lawrence River and the Canadian border.
You turn on the radio when you go up there, all the stations are in French.
Right.
Because you're not very far from Montreal. You're a little more than an hour from Montreal.
So these would be Canadian immigrants, Italian,
right.
Irish?
Right.
What was the mix?
So there are a lot of Canadians who come over.
Yeah.
French Canadians. Then recruiters from Alcoa went down to Ellis Island and they recruited people off the boat. And where'd they come from? They came from Poland and Hungary and Turkey and what's now the Czech Republic and Italy. And guess what? These were places where in the late 19th century, the blood libel against the Jews was common.
Yeah.
Then in Quebec, sadly, there were waves of anti-Semitism in the first two decades of the 20th century, and that anti-Semitism involved the ritual murder accusation against Jews. There's a really sort of celebrated, terrible case in 1913 of Jews from Quebec City being accused of being baby killers.
So I want to get to the lessons for today in the few minutes we have left, but just very quickly, the little girl was fine.
So what happened?
She got lost.
She got lost, and she was gone for about 24 hours. She got lost on Saturday evening, and about 24 hours later, she stumbles out of the woods. And by this point, everybody knew about this, and so a motorist saw her. They picked her up, drove her home. And then she gave an incredible interview with the local newspaper, the Messina Observer. And what she said was, is that she was cold and it was raining and she got under some bushes and she curled up in a ball. And this is probably why no one could find her. And she fell asleep. Oh. And there probably were searchers who came within a few feet of her.
Yeah.
But she was sleeping and she was curled up and they didn't see her. So I interviewed her.
Really?
She the first time I interviewed her, she was 91.
Oh, and my.
She passed away last summer at age 95. And so I talked to her twice. And unfortunately, she didn't have a lot of memories of the incident itself. But her memories were growing up, everybody would go up to her and say, oh, you're the little girl who started that whole thing.
Wow. Well, so we've got too little time left. We've got about 2.5 minutes left here. What did this incident mean for the community? And maybe on a secondary piece to that, after the fact, and then a secondary piece to that is what does it tell us about where we are today?
Yeah. Now, you can imagine how terrifying this was to the Jewish community of this little town. Most of the Jews had come from places in Europe where anti-Semitism was rampant. And so they were afraid. I interviewed a 102-year-old woman who was 16 at the time. She thought there was going to be a pogrom. And so, of course, they were relieved when little girl turned up unharmed. But then the rumor started to circulate, oh, the Jews let her go because they were afraid of getting caught. But the story has a happy ending because she came back alive. It was clear that this was, in fact, a libel. And so it actually sort of showed how some of the evils of anti-Semitism. I mean, here was this rumor that was completely false. It spread around anyway. And so in the national, this became a media event. The press covered this obsessively for about 10 days after it happened. And so the media event basically was saying that America is not this kind of thing. You know, we aren't anti-Semites. We don't make these allegations against Jews. And so, in the short and semi-long run, this was a happy ending for Jews. Nowadays, we have grounds for a bit of worry because in Europe and also in Quebec, anti-Semitism spread through media that were dedicated to anti-Semitism. That is, in places like Hungary, there were newspapers whose editorial line was hatred of the Jews. Mm-hmm. So was there in Montreal. And unfortunately, we have one case of an anti-Semitic newspaper in the United States, and that was Henry Ford.
Right.
Guess when he published his newspaper? In the 1920s. And so I think this helped set up the climate that could produce this allegation. So what's worrisome nowadays is that we have media online, like 8chan, that can spread these sorts of rumors. And I don't think we should be terrified, but it's something we should be vigilant about.
It is a powerful work, and congratulations. Thank you so much for being with us. Ed, that's where we need to leave it. It's a remarkable work. Congratulations. He's Edward Berenson. The book is The Accusation. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. He's Wayne. I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.